720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today and sharing part of your Saturday with me. We're sitting here on a very beautiful day, and we're watching lots of people walking by participating in the Women's March. Lots and lots of pink hats, lots of pink signs, lots of things, and we're going to keep checking in with Bob Kessler upstairs in the newsroom about those street closures and the crowd size and the latest and all of that good stuff. But lots to do here on the Wintrust Business Lunch today. Lots of business-related things to discuss, the first of which is Netflix. You know, we have talked many times about streaming services like Amazon Prime and Netflix and Hulu on this station, but Netflix is really at its largest right now. And so we thought we would check in about that. There's a really interesting piece that is in the Wall Street Journal right now. And here joining us to talk about that piece is Joe Flint from Wall Street Journal. Hi, Joe. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for sharing part of your Saturday with us. Well, so Netflix is really reporting some pretty impressive gains right now in a very large size. And that's due in part to the fact that it's kind of doubled down on international programming and really tried to appeal to a lot of different audiences. Tell us about that, if you would.
Well, Netflix is recognizing that the U.S. market, they're becoming much more popular here and more competitive as well. So they've really been pushing the last year or so aggressively abroad. Last year they flipped the switch on 130 new territories, and they announced last week with their earnings that they have about 44 million subscribers overseas to complement their nearly 50 million here. So you know, they are pushing abroad, both in terms of their reach, creating more content and acquiring more content tailored for the markets that they are in. And that's become kind of a large goal here, and also something of a tension with a lot of their U.S. programming suppliers as well, because as Netflix gets bigger and expands more, they want to have more control over where they distribute the program they acquire.
And how tight is that race with other U.S. competitors as they're talking about, you know, we're seeing numbers from them that are something like, as compared to this time last year, two thirds of a million, that's a ton of money that they're talking about. And, is the race that tight, or are they kind of the clear leader right now in this area?
Well, certainly they're the clear leader among streaming services. They have 49.4 million customers here, and that puts them way out in front of everyone else. And in fact, I'm beginning to almost think that comparing them to other streaming services really isn't the way to go, the proper metric to look at Netflix. In a way, I try to look at what they're doing in terms of their programming and their strategy. And basically, they are, to me, I look at them as another pay TV distributor. Mm-hmm. I look at them as competing against your Comcast and your Charter Communications and your DirecTV. They have everything those services have, except, of course, for the live sports networks and news channels, not a thing they're interested in. But they're trying to build a programming giant. You need kids programming, you can come to Netflix. You want unscripted, they're pushing into that, comedy into that. So they really are trying to be both a library of the best of television, as well as creating more and more original content, with an idea of being to ultimately perhaps replace your cable system.
Yeah, it certainly seems like that's the direction it's going. And talk to me a bit about the Brazilian market, because that seems like a particularly interesting case in which there was a great deal of skepticism when they first entered it, but they've managed to really invest and make a lot of headway there.
Yeah, I think there's been a lot of skepticism in a lot of markets they go into, but they are basically, you know, what they're doing is, yeah, they're acquiring, you know, when they're in the Brazilian market, and they have a Brazilian science fiction show that's become very popular in Latin America and the U.S. And they're not assuming that the shows they make here will work over there. The Brazilian show, by the way, is called 3%. And it's even building an audience here. But you know, they're recognizing that their content can travel across borders, but also that it's important to serve the markets you are in rather than just relying solely on exported content.
There was a note that you made in the story about all this that I thought was really interesting. Like, there's all these interesting details, and everybody should head to Wall Street Journal to check this out. But I think it's really interesting how they had to, and I think this is kind of a lesson for entering markets for anyone, really, about you can't just assume that the consumer behavior is going to be the same in each market. And it, to the extent even that how even affluent young Brazilians, as we're talking about that market in particular, a lot of them don't use credit cards. And so it became an issue of, it was just kind of an access issue, and they had to take all these alternative forms of payment, which I think is a really interesting lesson. I feel like that comes up a lot on the show as we talk about international markets, doing business internationally, and really programming and gearing your products towards an international market. That's really interesting. And I think it's a way we should all get out of our own way, really, and not assume everyone behaves like an American user.
Certainly, that's true. And I mean, to Netflix's credit, I mean, ultimately they're a business, so they will find a way to get that subscription fee from you, even if your method of payment is a rock through a window. But you do have to sort of adjust, you know, your content culturally, but also your way of doing business culturally is as well, and that's something that, you know, they are very cognizant of.
Definitely. Joe Flint, thank you so much for being with us. Entertainment reporter at Wall Street Journal. We will keep turning to you for this and other stories. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
All right, we're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we are going to be talking a little bit about some very in-demand jobs that are very specific to Chicago this year. So stick around for that. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today and sharing part of your Saturday with us. It is a lovely day here on Michigan Avenue. And of course, we're seeing a lot of people going past in pink hats and carrying signs and all that. Lots of people coming and going from the Women's March happening just a little bit south of here. And of course, we're going to check in here in just a bit upstairs in the newsroom with Bob Kessler to give you the latest on that and the associated street closures and all that good stuff. But still lots to do in the business related world here on the program. You know, there's a lot of jobs we've been talking about that are kind of jobs that didn't exist a few years ago, things like that, or the way that jobs have shifted. But there's a really, really fascinating story at Cranes Chicago. You can find it at chicagobusiness.com by Bridget Sweeney. That's all about 10 in-demand jobs that are really specific to Chicago this year. Joining us now to talk about that is Bridget Sweeney. Hi, Bridget. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Amy. Thanks so much for having me. How are you?
Great. Thanks so much for being with us today. So tell us about these jobs that are really going to be in demand, specifically in Chicago in the year ahead.
Absolutely. So overall, just across the nation, jobs that require creativity and then caregiving are obviously the kind of two ones that are the safest from automation. Here in Chicago, we see that a lot. I was talking to the head of HR at Advocate, and that health system is going to be hiring thousands of registered nurses each year for the next 3 or 4 years. So it's pretty remarkable just the number of hires that they will make. And the other thing I found really fascinating was just how in-demand data scientists are. Every single company, you know, from consumer packaged good companies like Kraft Heinz all the way to, tech companies and startups, they all need people to help them make sense of this overwhelming amount of data that companies have that helps them figure out how to reach their customers, how to make better business decisions. It's pretty remarkable.
It really is. And, you know, we've talked about this particular phenomenon on this show a lot about how Chicago is really what we're establishing ourselves for in the tech world. And it seems like medical related biotech seems to be very, very, especially with the investment from University of Chicago to really invest in those kind of startups, but also in that specific area of data and metrics. It seems like Chicago has really, really got a stronghold and has kind of made a name for itself as this hub of that particular aspect of the tech sector.
Absolutely. And I think it's especially interesting the data as it pertains to science and to the medical field. So I think between University of Chicago and then all strong hospital systems here. We have a real locus of the talent and the kind of brain trust. And I think in the future of medicine, a lot of people have been telling me it's going to be the combination of data and real individual awareness of each person's specific genetic makeup in terms of how to make these drugs and these clinical trials more and more effective. So again, yeah, data is everywhere. And people who really are talented at not only creating these databases and figuring out how to organize the data, but also drawing conclusions from it are really in demand.
It's really, really interesting, especially where those two things intersect. I think that's really, we'll make Chicago even more, you know, just strengthen this, the economy that we have here and all the things that we're coming together to do. And I think it's really interesting when skill sets are colliding, especially for such human good, right? Especially for something like medical and, you know, to help people become aware of the impact that they're having. I think that's really the best, most human part that we can get out of data that's so interesting. And then, so what about the, you know, technically skilled labor area? It seems like there's a little bit happening in that area too, as far as jobs in Chicago are concerned.
Yeah. And one thing that I found really interesting was the Internet of Things and the fact that that will trickle all the way down to electricians and, you know, all sorts of labor who may not need a college degree, may not need, a really advanced technical degree, but they will have the experience and they need to be trained as all of our devices and our homes get smarter and get connected to each other. You know, if the fridge breaks, that is going to be more interconnected. If you have a system where the fridge is talking to the microwave and everything's, you know, kind of together on one system. So that's going to be a big thing, which I thought was pretty fascinating. And then that kind of also ties into wind technicians, which I did not realize until I wrote the story that we have one of the biggest wind companies in the nation headquartered here in Benergy. And they are going to be hiring technicians and then also corporate people in their Loop headquarters this year. And that's a real, you know, booming sector just as we kind of continue to seek alternative forms of energy.
That's really, really fascinating. I think that's not commonly known that one of the largest in the nation is right here with Invenergy. That's really fascinating. An interesting detail for sure.
Great. Yeah. No, the whole thing was really, it kind of made me feel optimistic, honestly, after hearing, you know, kind of mixed economy news and bad economy news for so long. It really seems like, workers obviously have threats to them. Like always. And with the automation, I think people are concerned. There was a study that was done by McKinsey that kind of showed 50% of the work that people are paid to do today may not exist in 20 years. It will definitely be able to be done by robots or by other automated systems in the next 20 or 25 years. But at the same time, I think the automation is creating a need for people who have really strong both technical skills and higher level analysis skills to kind of direct all this automation, and it kind of creates new opportunities too.
Definitely. I think the Internet of Things part of that is super interesting too. I think that especially we're going to see really fascinating developments and ways that we have to challenge ourselves to expand and grow our knowledge to keep up for sure.
Absolutely.
All right, Bridget Sweeney, thank you so much for being with us. You can read this story and more from her at Cranes Chicago. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Amy.
All right, we're going to take a little break and get you to news and all that good stuff. And we'll be back in just a bit to talk about, you know, we've been talking a lot about Sundance. We certainly did this time last year, and Sundance is happening right now. But you know what? Getting a really big hit at Sundance may not mean the same thing that it did this time last year. We're going to talk all about that when we come back on 720 WGN. WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today and sharing part of your Saturday. Lots of people walking by, coming and going from the Women's March here in just a bit, or that's still happening, rather. We'll keep you updated with that. We'll keep checking in upstairs and a little bit later on John Williams' show. I hear they're going to be checking in with Andrea Darlis, who is down there at the march, so you definitely want to stay tuned for that. But still lots to do. In the meantime, still lots of business things to talk about. And, you know, this time last year, we were talking a lot about Sundance, how it used to be, you know, only the very large, established legacy film studios could come in and kind of give someone a big deal. And then last year we saw at Sundance that, and at South by Southwest, that the streaming services were coming in and making these deals with filmmakers. And that has shifted yet again in this fast-moving world that we live in. And that is, it's a really interesting place that it's in right now. Joining us now is Brooks Barnes, reporter from New York Times. Hi, Brooks. Welcome back to the program.
Hi, thanks. Sure.
So what has happened now? Because it seems like this time last year we were kind of all oohing and aahing over these really big, big money deals that were happening from the streaming services. But that's shifted again. So what's happening at Sundance now?
Well, the streaming services are still here with their checkbooks. Bidding hasn't really heated up yet. This will only started Thursday night.
Sure.
But Netflix has been buying some things. Amazon, others are expected to be buying as well. The mood this year is much more, much less ebullient, I would say, and that really has to do with a couple of things. One is the track record of some of the films from last year and in recent years is just harder and harder, or becoming rarer and rarer for these art film indie films to break into the mainstream. I mean, we found in the story I wrote today that in the last 10 years there have been 1,100 or so movies that have premiered at Sundance, and only one has taken in $40 million or more at the box office, which is kind of a benchmark for reaching a mainstream audience, a wide audience.
What one film
good.
Is that? Right.
Yeah, that was Precious. From I think 2009, and if you do you know, in today's prices, it took in about $57 or $58 million, I think.
Mm-hmm.
There's one from last year, Manchester by the Sea, that was bought here by Amazon last year. You know, that is kind of on the precipice and could chug into that territory depending on how it, you know, whether it gets Oscar love in the next month. But mostly, your Sundance movies, if they're doing any box office at all, are taking in less than $1 million. And that, you know, Sundance movies have always struggled. That's part of just, you know, the nature of what they are. They're niche, they're specialized taste often. But you did used to see movies that pretty routinely broke through. People forget, but Saw, the horror movie, was found here. Little Miss Sunshine is another example. Those both did nearly $80 million at the box office. Four Weddings and a Funeral was found here. You know, that's going back a ways, but sort of the dream of Sundance that allure mystique lives on. And we popped the bubble a little bit, perhaps.
Yeah, it's very, very interesting. So why is it that fewer and fewer are crossing over? Is it just volume? Is it there's just so many, you know, because equipment is a little more accessible to filmmakers and that sort of thing? Is it just there are so many that are reaching festivals now, or is it something else?
It's a couple of reasons we think that. One is that just the rise of streaming services and video on demand has made it much more much easier to see, you know, in your living room, these kind of movies or any movie. The problem with that is that none of that data is released. Netflix, Amazon, you know, VOD, just through regular cable companies. We have no idea how many people are watching. And so box office is really the only measuring stick left, you know, that we have to publicly look at that. But often a film from Sundance or any art film is staying in theaters for a very, very short window, maybe even a weekend, to qualify kind of as a movie, and then getting most of its run on television.
Right. And then we have to, of course, talk about The Birth of a Nation, which we saw,
right,
you know, last year, ended up being such an implosion, such a firestorm that went on around it. And so many things were sparked by that film.
The bidders, distributors, all say, oh, that was a special case, but it really does feel like that the people are being a little bit more cautious. That was a record price that Fox paid for that, Searchlight paid for that film, I think $17.5 million here for the rights. And so this time around, there's a little more like, oh, we'll take our time. There's no rush to, pay something that we may regret later, because what happened, I mean, they needed that movie at that price to take in $50 or $60 million at the box office, and it ended up at about 15 or 16.
Yeah, not so much. They didn't.
Not so much. Yeah.
Right. Didn't go as well on that one. But it's interesting to me, just the other day on the program, we were talking about what, because that sparked a lot of the Oscars So White movement. It was interesting to see how that has changed and shaped Oscars this year. And so that's such an interesting kind of catalyst point that we see, and how that manifested this year with the Oscar noms.
With the, on Tuesday, the Oscar noms come out. So, well, expecting that it won't be the same, fingers crossed.
Certainly,
in the world.
Right. Front runners certainly seemed a lot more diverse lineup than last year, for sure.
That is definitely true.
So we shall see. Well, so are you at, are you in Park City now?
I am. It's snowing outside. They just had the Women's March here. There are a bunch of movies coming out later, premiering later today, that should get buyers buying. There was one last night that has Judd Apatow as a producer that could sell for, $5-10 million, which is real money. But whether it finds an audience, that's always the question. And sometimes I think the thin altitude air, mountain air, can get to people.
Right. Well, as long as it's in favor of the filmmakers, we're okay with questionable mountain air judgment. Well, Brooks Barnes, thank you so much for being with us. We will keep
anytime.
Turning to you and all of your work at NewYorkTimes.com for the latest. Thanks so much, and have fun there.
Thanks.
All right, we're going to take a little break, and we come back. More to come here on the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. We're going to be turning things over to King John at 1 o'clock, and he's going to be checking in with Andrea Darlis, who is down at the Women's March. Of course, I've seen lots of very clever signs and pink hats running by here on Michigan Avenue, and I'm glad we have great weather for that event. There's over 150,000 people estimated to be downtown. I've heard the numbers might be even greater than that. So the march was canceled in favor of a rally, just because that is a lot of people to move around. But there's a lot of interesting stuff going on social media, and we'll keep checking in upstairs with Bob Kessler for the latest on that and the associated road closures, for sure. Well, a person we have talked about many times on this program is Mark Zuckerberg. And, there's a really interesting story at Bloomberg right now that is all about his Facebook page, because we think of, this guy's a CEO and he's running all this stuff and doing all the things, but yet he has a team that runs all of his stuff, as we probably could have guessed. And it is really, really interesting that he is kind of an example of a level of sharing that is probably different than a lot of other CEOs. Not that many CEOs share that much stuff in quite the open way that Zuckerberg does, that I think is really, really fascinating. I don't know. We talk about Facebook sometimes rather critically on this program, for sure. But, all in all, we're pro technology here. But it is a really interesting piece that I recommend you go to Bloomberg and check out, because I think it's a trick too. If you have I don't mean trick bad. I mean trick meaning, it's a hard to pull off thing to have a team manage your social accounts and yet still to come across so personally. I think there's a lot to that, and it is really, gets kind of tricky there. Bob Kessler, do you follow any of Zuckerberg's accounts? Or
I don't.
Or no.
Should I?
Well, I mean, he's interesting on Facebook for sure, because sometimes he is, really quite personal or quite emotional, or, particularly I think since he's become a father, he's been a lot more emotional.
Well, then maybe I'll follow.
He's interesting. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, we talk a lot about Facebook on this show and social media in general. And, you know, it's been interesting to me to see a lot of people have quit Facebook since the election. A lot of people are either because, like, you know, the dialogue is just too much. I can't go there. I don't want to go there. Kind of all the way to I just don't want to be tied to it. I don't want that much of my data there under this new administration. I mean, there's a lot of really I think a lot of people are kind of digging deeply about Facebook. And like why they're
rethinking,
why they're on it,
reprioritizing.
Yeah, they are. They're reprioritizing and rethinking their use of Facebook. But I think that might be an interesting feather in the cap of Twitter, because I've seen an uptick in Twitter users, or people that maybe don't use Twitter as often are suddenly using it a lot more. I feel like I've been using it a lot more since
all those people on the train I see they're going somewhere, unless they're just texting each other.
Well, there's that.
Because every time I'm on the train, that's what everyone does.
Well, people are reading. People aren't necessarily on social media just because they're using their phone.
That's true.
You know, I know that's my primary reading device because I...
Really?
Yeah. Because
it's too small.
Because I don't want to be carrying around books all the time.
Yeah.
Because a lot of times I'll leave the house in the morning, I'll be gone all day doing all the things. And if I was just carrying around a bunch of books, well,
you know.
Gets a little clunky. I mean, I usually have a book, but if it's a big book that I'm reading, nah.
So Mark Zuckerberg has, 840 million followers on Facebook? So you can personal message him.
Absolutely. That's his
He's
kind of...
not going to read it, though, necessarily. It's like sending an email.
Well, no, he won't,
but
his team might. His team might do it.
It's kind of like ghost writers for a biography that's being written.
Oh, that's an interesting way to think about that. Right. I mean, there's a lot of famous people that have like ghost tweeters and ghost Facebook people. There's a lot of that. I mean, that's a pretty plum gig to get, I think. But of course, it puts you under a lot of scrutiny for sure.
Yeah.
I know. Griffin, what about you? Do you follow Zuckerberg?
No. No.
And I never. Nope.
No. Well, no. Nothing to it, really. I just don't. But I never see his posts either.
See, that's the thing. I don't see them often either.
I don't know who's sharing them, but that story read something like 300,000. They usually get around 300,000 shares. Yeah. Which makes sense. I mean, he's a very famous, very powerful man, but I'm not seeing them.
But it is interesting. And as we talk about the Facebook algorithm, I think that was another thing that I think a lot of people were kind of upset about for the election of like, well, but I want just a straight feed of information. I don't want it to be skewed right or left or elsewhere. I want it to just be the facts. And I think a lot of people were pretty angry, or at least irked, that the Facebook news feed was so skewed.
And you don't, and it doesn't, it's not apparent.
Right.
It does present itself sort of like a straightforward filter of just what is being posted.
And it's not
you follow.
At all.
But no, yeah, it's very controlled. And it is interesting to see that he controls his own image the way that he likes his website to control its own. Right. I mean, it's expected. It makes sense.
Hey, did you see this kind of kerfuffle last night on Twitter, Griffin, about the new POTUS account?
I saw that it had been switched over, but I don't know what the kerfuffle is.
So the it had in fact been switched over, and there was a little bit of like, you know, Obama said, "Okay, follow me here. Here's the account I'm going to use," and Michelle did the same, and then suddenly the account is kind of cleaned out and changed over, and. There's this, you know, there's the new POTUS account that Trump is operating. It is unclear whether he will still use @RealDonaldTrump and POTUS or one or the other or both.
Yeah, I was wondering that. Yeah.
Well, I also read he had to give up his Android phone in favor of a secure device.
Well, I would hope because he's the president of the United States. Like,
that would make
again,
sense.
I That's would really move. Hope that some rein is put on the man, but with the tweeting. But nonetheless, a lot of people found themselves following him. Who had not consented to do so.
But were those people following the POTUS account previously?
And that's what everyone's kind of trying to figure out.
I figure that's
because there were several accounts that shifted usernames. So I think everyone was trying to figure out, was it that I was following White House or, you know, following the Obama POTUS account and it shifted when all the usernames were switched out? I think that's what everyone's still kind of left to figure out at this point, because I realized I was.
You were following POTUS?
As of yesterday.
But not before then? You must have been, right?
I definitely was. I mean, I follow...
Okay, well, see, that's the thing. Yeah, I mean, they just changed... The account changed hands, but the followers remained the same.
Indeed, but what I observed was people on Twitter saying, I specifically unfollowed at moment of inauguration and found myself refollowing it.
Interesting.
Which I think is very interesting.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe.
I know.
It
Who
seems
knows?
Like,
whatever.
Are you sure, though? Because I don't know. Yeah.
You know, there have been a lot of pink hats walking by today. I think I've just seen my favorite one, and that is someone has turned a pink flamingo into a hat and has just walked down Michigan Avenue with that going on. There's a lot of really interesting signs as people are leaving the Women's March. There's a lot of interesting signs and a lot of interesting hats going by and all that good stuff. Very interesting T-shirts. I've really enjoyed seeing some of the tiniest protesters with very cute messages on their shirts.
Yeah, the L getting downtown today was packed.
Yes, did you see? There was totally an packed. Interesting photo making the rounds, I think a video too, making the rounds on social media about a plane that was Washington, D.C. bound yesterday and entirely just filled with women. And it kind of became the nasty woman plane. And a lot of people were on it. And I think the flight attendants kind of embraced it and went with it. So it's a very interesting time. And it's certainly an interesting time to be on social media if you're not at a march or if it's not your thing even. There's a lot of interesting things to see on social media that's really just very thought-provoking. I know yesterday there was a lot of interesting things to behold that were happening in Washington, D.C., a lot of interesting video. And that's kind of the thing to me is that what an interesting time that we're in. And I realize I just said interesting about 18 times, but nonetheless, it is a fascinating time because the fact that almost all of us have a video camera in our pockets all the time has really changed the role of what it means to witness and what it means to be a bystander and what it means to observe resistance and political action and change in the world. I think that's very, very interesting because it used to be that we relied just on the access given to news organizations. And while that's still important, it's become a much richer and in-depth experience because we can see video. Because a photo, you can take a photo out of context, certainly. And you can say, I took this at this place, and there's really no proof otherwise, right? But with video, you see exactly what's happening. And although, sure, there are instances where video can be taken out of context in rare instances, but it's much harder to take a video out of context because you're seeing it as the witness sees it for the most part. And so it's a very interesting time, and I'm heartened by that. And I'm saying that in a bipartisan, nonpartisan way as much as I can, right? That across the board, we're seeing a richer experience of democracy right now because people are pulling out their phones, whether they were at the inauguration in support or in protest, or whether people are part of the Women's March or not today. It's really interesting to see video and all of that happening today. I love it. I think it's fascinating, and it's certainly making everybody's experience richer if they approach it that way, I believe. Anyway, so we should take a break and wrap things up and get you to news and turn things over to King John and all that good stuff. And again, he is going to be checking in with Andrea Darlis, who is down at the Women's March in Chicago. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN.